Great to have you with us today as we talk about the latest in Alzheimer's research, including the first blood test for Alzheimer's. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. And our guest back with us, Dr. Nathaniel Chin. Dr. Chin's a geriatrician, memory clinic doctor, and medical director for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Association. And he is also a host of the Dementia Matters podcast, which explores the treatment and care of people with dementia. We spoke with Dr. Chin actually last week about the latest research, and the following conversation is pre-recorded. Dr. Chin, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Larry. Great to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what, earlier this month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration cleared the first blood test to be used in diagnosing Alzheimer's. What's the significance of this new test?
We know on the research side, Larry, I think it's a culmination of all the hard work of scientists, researchers, and participants in getting to this point, in validating that we can detect Alzheimer's disease in blood. And so I think it really shows the hard work that has gone into the research. And then, of course, it's very exciting in the clinical space. So we are going to be translating what is done in research into clinics, and now we'll be using this in our patients. So we will have better and more accurate diagnoses of our clinic patients and being able to tell them what is happening in their brains, that we do think Alzheimer's is present, and now we can prove it with a blood test.
How many people roughly are there living with undiagnosed, untreated Alzheimer's?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question, Larry. I mean, we know that of those 65 and older, that there's over 7 million people with Alzheimer's dementia. And we know there's over 5 million people with mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's. And when we think about the presence of just that first protein of amyloid, we know there's probably over 40 million people who have just that protein. And so how many people who probably have symptoms, you know, it's in the millions. It's just a lot of people who are experiencing thinking changes. Those thinking changes could be related to this protein. But I don't want to say that as a scare people. You know, there's a lot of reversible causes too. And so to be clear, you know, when people experience memory loss or thinking change, you know, we tend to try to look for the reversible factor first, like sleep apnea, medication side effect, and so on. But there's a lot of people who likely have undiagnosed cognitive change due to this protein.
I'm wondering, how does that work? What's in your blood that signifies that you have Alzheimer's?
Well, I think the big thing here is that we really are redefining Alzheimer's disease. You know, in the past, people thought Alzheimer's was the same thing as dementia. And those are two separate things. Dementia being someone with thinking changes, changes on testing, and the most importantly, changes in their day-to-day activities where they just simply can't do some of the things they used to do. Alzheimer's disease now being defined as the presence of two proteins that are building up in the brain. The first protein being called amyloid, and then years later, the second protein being called tau. And so for years, we've been able to identify amyloid and tau in the spinal fluid, which is when people get a lumbar puncture. And then for decades, we've done really great research showing that we can detect that with these fancy PET scans, these imaging scans. But now, with the, you know, the great work that's happening here in Wisconsin in particular, we've validated that the proteins, these amyloid and tau proteins in the blood actually are reflected the same ones that are found in the spinal fluid and in those PET scans.
Pretty cool. How long does it take you to come up with, you know, after you take the test, how long does it take to, you know, find out for sure?
Just days. You know, it, and frankly, in the research side, it's really just hours that we could do this. But, you know, in a clinic setting, it's just sort of like getting a, you know, cholesterol panel or screening for diabetes. You get the blood drawn and a day or two later, it would result in your electronic health record. And depending on the arrangement of your healthcare institution, potentially you as the patient would be able to see this, or possibly it isn't yet shared and your healthcare provider would call you and talk to you about that result. It just depends on on the arrangement. This is a very sensitive piece of information, and so it may not be as readily accessible as something like your cholesterol panel, but it doesn't take very long at all, Larry.
Yeah, I would think if I went to my went online and looked without knowing that suddenly I'm a candidate or I have early Alzheimer's, that would be something I probably wouldn't want to know without talking to somebody in person or have them tell me in person.
Exactly. And I think one of the key things that I hope the listeners take away from our conversation is that a lot of counseling goes into just whether or not you want to get this test, you know, what the different results could actually mean, and then what the process looks like afterwards. You know, at University of Wisconsin Health and Clinics, UW Health, we've been sharing blood test results about Alzheimer's disease with our clinic patients for a while. And I will tell you, it is not a simple yes or no, you have it or you don't have it conversation. This takes a while to talk about. This is a lot. This is heavy information. And so it is a long conversation. And you really have to prepare people before they even get the test, and then actually sitting down with them and talking about the significance and the meaning of it. And so it is more than just yes or no.
Yeah, I read somewhere that sort of currently primary care doctors maybe correctly diagnose patients with only about 60% of the time. And this blood test is more accurate.
Yes, there has been a study that's out there. It was done in Europe, and it showed that primary care doctors were about 50 to 60% accurate at diagnosing Alzheimer's disease, that pathology specifically, and that memory care specialists like myself were about 70 to 80% accurate with all the tests available to us. And then this blood test is about 92%. Now, I'm going to push back on that result and just say, you know, human beings are more than just a simple singular test designed to detect this protein. And there's a lot that goes into this. So, you know, clinicians are really skilled at talking to people and understanding the experience of our patients. And so we can do a lot more than just look at pathology. And we provide a lot of care and intervention during our history and our interviews. And so this test is really good at detecting this singular protein. But certainly can aid in the evaluation process that clinicians and primary care doctors are capable of doing. And so, you know, I know there is a lot about, is a blood test better than your clinician? And I don't think that's true. I think our clinicians are excellent, or primary care doctors are excellent, but this is a great tool to help us in being even better.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering who could take this test. I mean, could anybody go into their primary and say, hey, I want this blood test?
Well, as of now, the FDA approved this test for people in a specialty clinic. So that would usually be a neurologist, a geriatrician, or a memory clinic provider. And it would be for individuals who have a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So it would not yet be in primary care, and it would not yet be for people who are cognitively healthy or don't have any symptoms. When the FDA looked at the evidence or the data, it was really just in the people, the participants who had impairments. So they validated it just for those who already had cognitive change.
Yeah. How were UW-Madison researchers involved in developing this blood test?
Yeah, so my colleagues were very much involved. So they contributed 40% of the data that was used by the FDA to make this determination. And that means that the Great Wisconsin participants, so the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, those participants, and then the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, the RAP study, those participants. So about 200 of them donated or gave their blood and their spinal fluid, and they had to do both. And so they did blood draws and lumbar punctures, and so they gave those samples, and then they were analyzed, and they showed that the proteins in the blood matched the proteins in the spinal fluid with good accuracy, and that was really what was used to show that this blood test was good enough to be used in the clinical space. And so 40% of that data just came from our centers.
Oh, that's very cool. It's got to, I think, in order to, for a test to be approved by the FDA or cleared, I guess I should say, you need a lot in order to have it cleared.
Oh, absolutely. We need to be confident that what we're measuring is true, that it has a high standard, because we don't want to be using data that we're not sure about or tests that we're unclear about when it comes to our clinic population. You know, in research, we can have this open, honest conversation with participants about what we don't know. But in clinic, when we're making treatment decisions about this, when it's not voluntary, it's about clinical care, we have to have the highest standards. And so for the FDA to approve this test, it really showed that it met those high standards.
And I'm wondering the benefits of, or should I say, what benefit is there to catching Alzheimer's early before it's progressed?
Well, I think there's a lot of benefit to knowing what's happening. So I think just the personal benefit of putting a name to something that you've been experiencing in understanding this is the reason I've been experiencing these changes, or for family, putting a name to what you've been witnessing. So often you're struggling with why is this happening? What's going on with my loved one? And so this is a confirmation that something is going on. It's not just them doing this. And then, of course, earlier intervention. And so whether it's a referral to a clinical trial, or now there are two FDA-approved medications to remove this protein, this amyloid protein, and so that would be a treatment option. Or it's just other care. I mean, these medications are only a part of clinical care. And so having a diagnosis means, or could mean, that a person engages in other treatments, other lifestyle interventions, other care supports. And it can be really motivating for someone to say, this is what's happening to me. I know this, and now I'm going to move on. I'm going to move forward and take the next steps to live the best life that I can.
You know, I know someone whose mother had Alzheimer's, or was at least diagnosed with it, whose brother had it, and whose sister has it. Makes me think that there's some family history involved with Alzheimer's. How much does family history affect Alzheimer's risk?
Yeah, this idea of family history is real. We know that Alzheimer's can quote, run in families. A lot of times, though, that is related to a particular risk gene, and it's called apolipoprotein E, or as most people know it, ApoE. And it's called a risk gene because it's not a guarantee, meaning you can have it, ApoE4 in particular. This is the risk gene. But it doesn't mean you're going to develop Alzheimer's. It just means you're at a higher risk of it. And so many times when people describe having multiple family members, you know, if they were to do their genetics, they could have one or two copies of this ApoE4. And so that would be one. There are other risk genes as well, but they're not as influential or impactful as ApoE4. There is another type of Alzheimer's called early onset Alzheimer's, or autosomal dominant. And that's the type where, if you were to see it on TV, where people are developing Alzheimer's dementia in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s. And this is where you have one of these copies and you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease. It's less common. It's 1-2% of the time. And that truly does run in the family, but that's usually not the case when you're hearing those stories. It's usually one of the ApoE4 stories or different type of risk gene.
Mm. Dr. Nate Chen, our guest today, he is the medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At 11:30, a dementia care expert joins us to talk about how to communicate with your loved one experiencing memory loss. And at noon today, we will turn our attention to dental care. Right now, I'm talking with Dr. Nate Chen we started talking about the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's clearing of the first blood test to be used in diagnosing Alzheimer's and its significance. So glad to have you with us today as we talk with Dr. Chen. Currently, how do doctors diagnose Alzheimer's? Is it just by experience primarily, or?
You know, in general, most memory specialists, neurologists, primary care doctors would try to diagnose the syndrome of mild cognitive impairment or dementia first. That's sort of a collection of symptoms, using history, ruling out reversible causes, doing some cognitive testing, a physical exam. And then you do get some blood work, some standard blood work, trying to rule out certain conditions, and then potentially a CT or an MRI of the brain scan. And again, that's trying to rule out certain conditions. And then ultimately, it is your clinical judgment. It's your history, the cognitive tests, and really just based on your experience. There hasn't been the ability to rule in, meaning that really I confirm the biological cause of Alzheimer's disease for some time, although I will say specialists have been able to use spinal fluid. It's just that it hasn't been as common. And so the blood test is going to really change the way we approach the confirmation of Alzheimer's disease.
And I'm wondering, what are the conditions that often get confused with Alzheimer's?
Well, I would start by just saying most people think Alzheimer's is the same thing as dementia, and that to this day, most people will think that. And that's, there's a lot of stigma because of that. And that's unfortunate because many people can be diagnosed very early with mild cognitive impairment, where they're having just a couple of thinking changes, some mild forgetfulness, and they'll just have one, maybe two sort of lower scores on their thinking tests, and that's it. They can do everything they day-to-day activity-wise. They're very independent, very capable individuals. And then we find out that they have this amyloid protein in their brain. And so that technically is mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's. And so people can get confused by the Alzheimer's part and think, oh, no, I have dementia, when actually they have mild cognitive impairment. And so Alzheimer's is not the same thing as dementia, dementia being just a further along part of the process. And then I would say many people think that all memory loss is due to Alzheimer's disease, and that's also not the case. You know, memory loss can be due to lots of different things, medication side effects, sleep apnea, depression, hypothyroidism, so having a low thyroid. And so it's really important to evaluate for those conditions first, because those are all very treatable. And if we do get to those early enough, we can actually reverse memory loss completely. By treating those conditions.
Yeah. And I know I have friends who have done this, and I've done it myself. You kind of, maybe you forget where you put the car keys, or you might meet up with somebody that you know, and it takes you a second or two or longer sometimes to come up with their name. Is this some kind of precursor to dementia or Alzheimer's?
Usually not, Larry. So usually that would be what we call normal age-related change. And that tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon, or walking into a room and forgetting why you did that, which is usually more of an attention issue than it is a memory issue. When they happen sporadically, or when that name does eventually come to you, or that word eventually comes to you, that's usually not an issue. The one thing that is hard, though, is it is hard to differentiate normal aging from something that is pathological, which is why you ideally you would report that to your primary care doctor and potentially have, evaluation. But more often than not, unless it's persistent, unless it's being noticed by others, unless it's really interfering with how you get through the day, there's a good chance that it is just normal aging. It doesn't mean ignore it. It just means perhaps don't panic as much. And talk about it and really see if there's other factors, like you're just not sleeping as well, or perhaps you're having too much to drink, or perhaps you're, there are other factors. And so before jumping to the conclusion that it's Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Oh, man, I've thinking about this blood test, a great sign of progress here. And I'm wondering, in the last, decade or so, how is our knowledge of Alzheimer's disease expanded?
It is rapidly accelerating. It's taken us a long time to get to this point, Larry, because it's been so hard to really identify the proteins of Alzheimer's disease. And now that we've been able to do that, we can really understand, well, what are the factors that are leading to the development of this protein? What's happening between amyloid and the development of the next protein? What is lifestyle doing that could be modifying this? what are the social determinants of health? What are the lifestyle or what are the environmental genetic access issues that could be affecting how our brains are functioning and our ability to think? And so it really helps form a framework for researchers to ask really important questions. And then, of course, then it expands into other areas of brain disease. And so this is one blood test looking for Alzheimer's, but there are going to be other blood tests looking for the other brain diseases like Lewy body disease and TDP-43 is another different protein. And so it's really allowing for the field to get to a point where we, with a simple blood draw, can look for multiple different brain processes to help people figure out what's going on and what are the different interventions that we can do to help you.
Yeah. I'm wondering if there ever could be a cure. I mean, how close are we? Are we a million miles away from a cure for Alzheimer's?
Cure is harder because we would have to stop the disease and then bring brain cells back. But the idea of stopping the disease in its tracks is certainly feasible. We have to be able to identify the disease, come up with interventions to stop it. And that's something I think the field is working on. And then also prevention. You know, I mentioned we're part of the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention Study. That's the RAP study. We're very focused on this idea of, you know, how can we prevent the development of these proteins or the development of symptoms? And now that we can identify this in blood, you know, what do those interventions look like? What is the lifestyle? What are the social environmental factors? What are the pharmaceutical treatments that we could be giving to prevent this? And so I think the field is expanding in that area. And so that seems much more feasible. Cure is not out of the question. It just seems a bit further out than this idea of disease modifying, stabilizing, and ideally preventing.
Yeah. That would, I don't think we'll see that in my lifetime, but let's hope down the road that we have something like that. The difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, I mean, can dementia be cured?
Well, so dementia is when you actually are losing and you've lost brain cells. And so, you know, the goal would be, can we stop the worsening of dementia? Can we stop whatever the disease is that's causing those, you know, brain cells to die? That would be the goal. And then there are clinical trials actually looking to grow brain cells. You know, what can we do to generate more brain cells? And what we do know is you can generate more brain cells and you can generate connections among brain cells called synaptogenesis. And actually one of the best things you can do for that is exercise. And so, but they're looking at drugs too. And so it would take stopping disease and then, you know, growing more brain cells. And there are scientists looking at that. So the field is very broad and diverse, and they are considering that. And so it's not out of the realm of possibility, but that certainly is a hard thing to do.
And the prognosis for someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
Well, as of now, this is a terminal condition. And so in general, you know, when you are diagnosed with dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, they say it's anywhere between 5 and 9 years before you would pass away. You know, we see longer courses than that, and we see shorter courses. And I would certainly say now people know so much more than they did years ago. And so we certainly see the quality of life improve compared to decades ago. And there's lots of great resources and care supports for people living with Alzheimer's, living with dementia, and their care support, their care partners. And so we do know that when you support the people caring for people living with Alzheimer's and those living with dementia, the end result is better. And so we are doing a better job in providing care than we did decades ago.
Dr. Chin, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll be calling you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Larry.
Dr. Nate Chin, Medical Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Thanks to him, and we'll be right back after these messages. I'm Larry Mueller.